Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Ben Ennis, Blake Murphy. I need a new commuting food because I used to do, I commute. You don't give me a look. Like I like to, you know, nosh a little bit during my 1 hour drive to and from work. And I used to just chew gum, but I have a gum chewing problem in that my tongue is too big and I kept biting my tongue and that would leave me in disrepair for like a week. So I was off gum. Now I've been doing sunflower seeds and I think it's upsetting my stomach, Blake. Like, do you have any advice?
No, I don't commute. I walk to work and it's not long enough to require a snack. I like sunflower seeds, but I've never in my life, even at the most competitive, stressful of SPO slow pitch tournaments, have I ever eaten enough sunflower seeds in a day to make myself not feel well.
Buddy.
It's a lot of sodium. I imagine you come in here pretty parched. And yeah. Then once you drink the requisite water to feel unparched, you then feel kind of bloated.
Yeah.
That cycle is probably what's doing it.
And it's vicious.
And then you top it off with, you have a coffee when you come in.
Yeah. No, it's not good. It's not quite the Adnan Virk, like, coffee and chili, which is the all-time, like, set you back a couple hours during your day. But, yeah, no, it's not great. I need something else.
I have
else.
Tums in my bag.
Do you?
Yeah. Or, sorry, I have non-branded antacid tablets in my bag.
I may take you up on that in the break. Anyways, if you have any suggestions, hit me up at Sportsnet Ben. Today's top story brought to you by Thornhill Toyota. Your local Toyota store since 1969. Come for the history. Stay for the future. Dufferin North of Steeles is a baseball move, but it's one not done by the Blue Jays, but impacts the Blue Jays pretty directly because this is a guy we spent a lot of time talking about. Blue Jays are going to have to pivot here after Andrew Heaney signs with the Rangers. It's a two-year, $25 million deal. It includes an opt-out after year one if he's good again. And there's incentives that could raise it up to $40 million. He was good in very limited sample last year with the Dodgers. The strikeout rate was super high, despite the fact that he doesn't throw 99 when he wasn't striking people out. Sometimes they hit it a long way and really hard. And so that's the story Blue Jays fans will tell themselves today, that that's not going to work in the AL West. But now it's, okay, we're pivoting. It's no Justin Verlander, which, again, more reporting from our Shai Davidi and Ben Nicholson-Smith. The Blue Jays were legitimately involved in discussions with Justin Verlander. So pivot off him, different price point, obviously. They were definitely in on Andrew Heaney, according to just about everybody, pivoting off of him. And now, Blake, I think we're left with perilously few pitchers in free agency that have a super high upside. Not to say that Andrew Haney is going to be like an American League Cy Young Award winner, but the potential exists for him to be very good on any given day.
It certainly does. He is about as boom or bust as they come, in which case he's a pretty interesting contrast to, say, a Ross Stripling, who we believed would have similar markets, where Ross Stripling is more of the, well, okay, maybe you're giving up 2/5 every time, and Heaney's more of a, well, you're getting 7 shut out, and then I'm not getting out of the first inning. And the reason why is, yeah, you bring up the, pick your stats page, pick your, however you want to look at it, and it's, well, nobody can get to it. No one can make contact with it. And if they make contact with it, they are going to hit a home run. It's a pretty interesting profile. And it makes you wonder, you know, what exactly a Texas Rangers or look, a lot of teams were in on Heaney. Chris Cotillo reported that he had 10 different offers. We'd heard the Blue Jays made an offer. There had been some reporting that he was even getting into the 3 or 4 year range with some of these offers. Maybe he valued the ability to opt out the old bet on yourself contract a little bit more. He gets the second year of security, but potentially if he has, you know, he had 72 innings of 3.10 ERA this year. Let's say he puts up 140, 150 of 3.5 ERA, probably stands to make significantly more next offseason as a 32-year-old. So there are a lot of different ways that could go. If you are looking at the ever dwindling list of available pitchers.
Yeah, there's not many.
Carlos Rodon.
He's good.
It's also kind of odd how quiet everything's been on the Rodon front.
That's right.
And then you start to wonder, what's Ross Stripling up to?
Yeah, but again, and we love Ross Stripling. Who doesn't love a Ross Stripling interview, first of all, and who didn't love to watch him pitch when he transitioned to the starting rotation this year for the Toronto Blue Jays? But like, even in your most optimistic Ross Stripling estimations for what he could be over the course of a multi-year contract in free agency here, it's unlikely that you're like super pumped about Ross Stripling starting a postseason game. And certainly he's not jumping the queue of Alek Manoah or Kevin Gausman to start game one of a postseason series. Carlos Rodon would. And that's about it. Like, that's, you look at the rest of the free agents, like Chris Bassett, nice player. Jameson Taillon, yeah, sure. And a little experience in the division. These are not pitchers that you're necessarily selling yourself on what they're going to cost you in free agency, because free agents cost more than what their value is. So if the reality is here, Blake, that you had a choice, either you sign your pitcher and you trade for your position player, or you sign your position player and you trade for your pitcher here. To me, I think this is pivot central here, where yeah, you maybe trade for your pitcher, and then you use the money that apparently can go above and beyond $200 million in payroll, and it's a Brandon Nimmo type situation, or maybe you're doing less than Brandon Nimmo, but that's where you spend your money, on the position player side and maybe not the pitching side. That's what I'm gleaning from this.
Unless there's something cooking with Rodon that we just haven't heard about,
yeah,
or you're really high on Kodai Senga's ability to translate those strikeout rates to
agent said he only visited one country, visited like seven cities, but only one country. So I guess an indication.
Apparently getting 5 and 6 year offers, which you probably don't want to do. And this front office doesn't have a deep track record of doing. There are interesting pitchers to trade for, of course. We just went through a deadline and a preseason before that where there was a lot of talk about what starters the Blue Jays could potentially trade for. I will keep forever coming back to the name Pablo Lopez, because sure, Miami has a lot of young pitching, that are, you know, getting into their arb years and deeper than that, and they have a lot of needs elsewhere. Maybe that's a situation. And I know Sandy Alcantara is the...
Yeah, get him.
Yeah, that's the big, big ticket item. But Pablo Lopez is a step down in asset costs and has been very, very good since entering the majors, with the exception of 2019. Not Andrew Heaney strikeout rates, but limited walk rates, a lot of ground balls, a lot of things in the pitch profile that look pretty sustainable. And yeah, like a tiny bit of injury red flag history, but he threw 180 innings this year, which is, short of Sandy Alcantara, about the most anyone throws anymore.
Yep. He was in a pretty good pitching environment, but he's been in less pitcher friendly environments, but he's just really good. Like, I got it. Rodon is very, very good, but yeah, not a guarantee.
Sorry, that was on Pablo Lopez. Rodon is another class altogether, but I thought we were moving on from that to the trade front.
Yeah, okay. And you're right. Pablo Lopez is a guy that the Blue Jays have been linked to routinely. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's the route they go down right now. It's hard to imagine any of these free agent starters outside of Carlos Rodon being an impact player in the postseason. No offense to Drew Smyly or Jose Quintana. The other thing that came out of today's winter meetings conversation was Cody Bellinger and the connection to the Blue Jays again. But now we have a number, I suppose. Like, he's looking for $20 million, because of course he is. But when we're talking about the Dodgers non-tendering him, like, that was going to be pretty close to the price for Cody Bellinger, right? Like $18-19 million. Not sure, even despite the MVP season, which is well in the rearview mirror, that anybody's going to sell themselves on $20 million, even in a one-year deal for Cody Bellinger and his great defense in center field.
No, I am not. When we've discussed Bellinger between us on the show, it's been more of the buy low on a make good one-year deal that lets him get playing time and re-enter the market. If you are paying $20 million for Cody Bellinger, I would argue that unless you know, unless there you have some evidence that 2018, 2019, Cody Bellinger can come back through that door. And again, that some of that is going to be dependent on what his shoulder looks like medically. $14 million for Teoscar Hernandez and a downgrade on defense, probably a better bet than $20 million for Cody Bellinger. And they will both be 1 year deals since Teoscar was an outbound free agent. The other thing is, yes, the Dodgers, in terms of the qualifying offer, if they believed Cody Bellinger's market was $20 million, they would have given him the qualifying offer. And there would have been a lot of tax implications given how deep into the CBT they are. But if they thought the market for him was $20 million, you sign him to the qualifying offer, and then if he signs it, you trade him because you have established that the market is $20 million.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that the Dodgers thought that. And yeah, it's, I don't know, $20 million when the whole talk around the guy is he needs a spot where he can have a bounce back season and re-enter the market. Like $20 million is way above what I was expecting to hear with Cody Bellinger. Like I thought it might top out around 15, and I thought 10-12 was much more likely and reasonable.
Yeah. We're talking, I understand Brandon Nimmo is like a longer commitment than 1 year, $20 million, and you pay a premium to sign a guy to a short-term deal. But yeah, Brandon Nimmo is not going to make all that much more on an annual basis than $20 million. I doubt he's going to make 25. And I think Brandon Nimmo is a safer bet to be a more valuable player in 2023 than Cody Bellinger. I think if that's the price point for Cody Bellinger, then the Blue Jays are probably not in the Cody Bellinger sweepstakes.
Probably not. Or this is what we get all the time at winter meetings, which is agents are putting high numbers out there. I mean, we've already seen very quickly the leak of Andrew Heaney has 3-year offers and maybe a 4th year, and then it comes in, he signed a 1+1.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This is the week for agents to lean on those leverage buttons. You maybe also have a situation where a certain agent represents several of the outfielders available on the market.
Yeah.
And as risky as this is, this particular agent doesn't really worry about the risk side of things. Maybe you are trying to inflate Cody Bellinger's market, because that in turn ratchets up the pressure on a Brandon Nimmo conversation.
Yeah. And Scott Boras spoke to our own Ben Nicholson-Smith, and we will speak to BNS after 6 o'clock today, as there's the potential for more information coming out of San Diego today. But that was today's top story, brought to you by Thornhill Toyota. It was, I guess, maybe a bad news story for Toronto sports fans, Blue Jays fans, that, you know, maybe you'd sold yourself on Andrew Haney and his 75 innings last season.
I don't think people are. The impression I've got is that fans are not necessarily angsty about not getting Andrew Haney. It's having not done, like, the offseason so far is a net loss.
Yeah.
Teoscar Hernandez out, Ross Stripling potentially out, and then Eric Swanson in.
Yes, that's bad. But I mean, this, it does harken back to a couple of off seasons in recent franchise history in which there's been a lot of discourse about how disappointed people were. And then, oops, pal, surprise, here comes George Springer and outbidding the New York Mets for him.
A lot of time left before pitchers and catchers report.
Yeah, it is true. So, yeah, maybe not such a depressing conversation. The conversation around the Raptors, though, is seemingly quite depressing here. Blake, as they lose 116-110 to the Boston Celtics, which on its face doesn't seem all that disappointing, right? Like, you hang in there against the best team in the NBA, on pace to have the greatest offensive season in the history of the sport. But yeah, missing a starter and a key contributor off the bench on the back end of back-to-backs, you're pretty healthy. And a narrative is starting to form here around Fred VanVleet, who you talked about yesterday being like slump free since 93, just like doesn't do it. He's slumping pretty hard right now, Blake.
Mm-hmm.
He's 5 of 28 from 3 over his last 4 games. There was this report today that Nick Nurse said Fred VanVleet's right left number in the way they evaluate jump shots and the mechanics is a little bit off, which is a bit strange. I'm glad there's an explanation for what's happening here, because boy, they could have used that corner 3 to go down at the end of that game yesterday. I'm not saying I'm out on the Raptors, who I just recently called the third best team in the Eastern Conference, but they're a tough watch right now.
It's been a tough go since you said it would be an abomination to end all abominations.
Maybe a bit of an exaggeration.
You said
it was, but not far off.
Yeah. It hasn't been the best stretch, and kind of the target has moved a little bit on what's been the problem game to game. Some days it's defense. You know, Scottie Barnes had his stretch of games where he didn't look great. He's rounded into form offensively, and now it's Fred VanVleet's turn. And I meant what I said about Fred VanVleet being relatively slump proof. I dove through the game logs for his career, and this 5-for-28 stretch is the fourth worst stretch of shooting he's had over any four game set, and by far the worst with this kind of volume. Like, we're talking about the other ones, he maybe went like 3-of-15 or something like that over four. 28 threes over four games is a lot of threes.
Yeah.
Fewer than he normally takes, but yes, this stands out a lot. Perhaps more concerning is that if you zoom out to 13 games, so back to when he first missed a little bit of time with the back injury, he's sitting on 30.5%. That's also, other than post All-Star break last year, that's also one of his very worst shooting stretches over an expanded sample. And then you start to look at, well, there's that sample from post All-Star last year, and then there's this one, and now you've got like almost a calendar year where he hasn't shot the ball very well.
Uh-oh.
He's also not finishing super well at the rim.
Well, he never has, really, right?
It was kind of the big thing in his jump to All-Star status last year, though, was that he took a jump as a finisher.
Mm.
That has gone the other way. So I don't have much doubt that Fred VanVleet will figure this out and be back to the Fred VanVleet we normally see and expect. It's almost like a running bit that over the years, every time this conversation creeps up because Fred VanVleet has a couple bad games or the team has one good game without him, the fan base or some of our friends or whoever will try to trade Fred VanVleet. And then he misses like two more games, and then everyone's like, oh my goodness, this team needs Fred VanVleet so badly. He's a big time, like, absence makes the heart grow fonder guy. So I don't have a lot of doubt that he will figure it out and right the ship. I am at a little bit of a loss for what that tipping point is. And Will Lou and I talked about it a little bit more on the Raptor show today. It's just normally if one part of your game is slumping, it can be easy to be positive about it because you look at the other things you're contributing or you say, yeah, well, if the three-point shot comes along, look at how good everything will look. But because it's the finishing that's off, the three-point shooting that's off, he missed a handful of pull-up mid-range jumpers yesterday against Al Horford dropping back in defense, which is usually his bread and butter. It's just a little tough to figure out what to hone in on and watch for to give you the signal that Fred's turning the corner. So I think he'll get there. I just am less confident in identifying what needs to be tweaked for him than I have been if he's slumped in the past. And the thing you mentioned earlier about the right left. So for anyone who doesn't know, the Raptors have, and they've had for years, but now it's a big story because they have these giant boards in OVO Athletic Center that show all the stats and the readings. But they have this tool that gives you real-time feedback on your jump shooting on all their nets. And it can be, you can visualize it or you can get audio feedback. So you take a three and you miss and it says, 1 degree right or 2 degrees right or whatever. And it lets you know that you were just off a little to the right and you can adjust that mechanically.
Even if you make the shot
in real time.
Right? Like you're trying to make it right, like it, perfect dead nut center.
You want to graze back rim on the way in is what you want to do. So generally, if Fred VanVleet has slumped, it's a little bit of too long, too short, but generally he is the most effective when it comes to shot consistency and stuff like that with the team. So what Nick Nurse was pointing out is like, this is pretty rare for him to buy, not just buy small sample in game, but also on their metrics outside of games to be a little off.
Okay. So that's a little bit concerning for a guy that's been so consistent with that shot. But this, you've talked about, I mean, and everybody talks about the three-pointer being a high-variancy shot, right? Mm-hmm. That you can slump and then, you have a good stretch of games and that a small sample even of four games or, I mean, a calendar year is getting a little bit longer.
Statistically, a calendar year still isn't really that stable for three-point percentage, though. Like, we need about 700 three-point attempts before we're pretty confident saying this change in three-point skill is real or this downstep in three-point skill is real. It's the stabilization point is very, very high for three-pointers, and that's before getting into, like, well, more Freds are pull-up threes than an average player and stuff. I will say that I think being able to identify mechanically where you're off for a lot of guys is probably very helpful. I don't know that if it's universally helpful, like knowing that, okay, I'm a little off left, right. Like I don't know, that could make me feel better about things because you know what the issue is and you can attack it. But also, I don't know, knowing what it is weird.
Well, if you can fix it, like if there is some salve you can just throw on it and all of a sudden you come out the other end and you're back to being your close to 40% three-point shooting self.
Mm-hmm.
If there is like a question mark as to why it's happening, that seems also bad. So I don't want to make this entirely about Fred VanVleet, but I do like, so that was a pretty good, I don't know, show me game, litmus test, whatever you want to call it, that the Raptors have had some games against teams that expect to be in the postseason and peripherally involved in the championship conversation in the Brooklyn Nets and the Sixers, who I assume are going to look very different, by the end of the season and they're 0-3 against the Nets, it should be stated. But this was the first game against a team that, like, is one of the favorites to win it all. And I guess the Nets are creeping up there. And they got a Lakers team coming in that's all of a sudden
8 of 10.
Yeah, they're on fire as well. And Anthony Davis has scored 99 points, I think, in his last two games, which is good.
I mentioned this yesterday, too. If you don't take one of these games, then, okay, you've got a set of two at Orlando on the weekend and then Sacramento. And then guess what's next after that? Brooklyn, Golden State, Philadelphia.
Right.
So you could be sitting there around Christmas time with only wins against the teams you have to beat. Like, they beat Cleveland on November 28th. It's possible they don't beat another good team until December 21st. And then and even then, that would be the Knicks. Obviously, a lot can change, and they'll take some of those games. They're not going to lose every game against a good team. But this is part of why games like yesterday can hurt a little extra, because not only was this, you know, we talk about how tough the schedule was early in the year, and that will pay its way back to you by having rest advantages and things like that later in the year. And you get Boston on the second night of a back-to-back, missing two guys, and you're in the game, and it just kind of slips away. And you can identify, well, okay, you started better and you closed as well as you've been closing, but you still had that one quarter lapse that has plagued you a little bit. It feels a little extra frustrating, I guess, when it's that level of opponent and you play that well for the most part and it still kind of flitters away, just kind of slips out of your fingertips.
And there were some, like, some bizarre plays like OG Anunoby fumbling the ball out of bounds. And again, Fred VanVleet missing a wide open corner three in a 5-point game. But I think in the overall, the Raptors were the inferior team throughout the course of 48 minutes against a team that is the favorite to win the title. But where I'm going is, and there's a long way to go until the trade deadline, it's February. I don't want to trade away Fred VanVleet either. But this is a different trade deadline than a season ago. Because Fred has a player option, so, I mean, maybe that factors in. So does Gary Trent Jr. But those are potential free agents at the end of the season, right? And the conversation going into this year was, I think a lot of people looked at the potential using of Gary Trent Jr.'s money to facilitate some trade to bring in talent to help this team headed towards the end of the season and into the postseason. These are games that I think are important for this front office to determine, like, how worth it will be to continue to accumulate talent to buy at a deadline that, again, is a long ways off, and it's only one game against the best team in the NBA by 5 points. But, again, we already mentioned the caveats there.
And it's a team that if you are going to add at the trade deadline, then teams like Boston and Milwaukee and Brooklyn are teams you are measuring yourself against.
Yeah.
And what showed last night is that even when you play pretty well, and I know people are going to look at 116 and be like, how do you give up that many points? That, on a per-possession basis, was a below-average night for the Celtics this year.
Yeah.
Like, they are that lethal offensively right now. But, yeah, you look at that, and they're missing two players. They're on the second night of a back-to-back. You play pretty well, and there's still a gap there. That's something you have to think long and hard about, and this is why all 82 games are equal in the standings. But sometimes I think games over this next month or two is not, yeah, the highest leverage spot of the schedule, because it is for a 500 team. What happens over this next month is going to inform what you do heading into the trade deadline more than any other stretch. If you turn it on and you go 10-3 over the next little bit, this is a team that has probably earned additions.
There's a level of unknown with this team, mm-hmm. too, right? Like, I mean, Scotty Barnes, he's surprised out of the gate for some people, but wins Rookie of the Year, was a key contributor to this team, and they take off in the second half, and they give the Sixers a run for their money in the postseason. But that was who knew what was going to happen, considering the couple of years prior to last season. Now, did we expect to just extrapolate over that performance in the second half of the season into the postseason for 82 games this year? Maybe that was unfair, but I think that this is still kind of a fact-finding mission with this team and understanding how close you are to contention. And it's, you're not talking about like tearing it down to the studs or anything, but yeah, there's, we know that Masai Ujiri, Bobby Webster are in it to win it. They're not just in it to, hey, you know, take our chances in the first and second round over the next half decade to a decade. So what does that mean?
We'll see. The honest answer is that I don't know right now. And, you know, they started about this poorly last year, maybe even a little worse. And then by the time the trade deadline rolled around, everyone wanted additions,
yeah,
because things were clicking and they looked good. And that's why I mean this next stretch, especially with games like the Lakers and the Warriors, those are games where you got to show that you can compete with that tier, because otherwise, yeah, you have to look at the difficult decisions like that Norman Powell trade. And that was the Tampa year, so like, who cares really?
Right.
But those are hard decisions you can face every year where your guys have value. That's how you become a 500 team. So yeah, tough decisions ahead, and this next stretch will tell us a lot. Also telling us a lot, John Heyman of the New York Post says Aaron Judge is a San Francisco Giant.
Oh boy. Okay. Well, that's exciting.
Although John Heyman is now retracting his own tweet.
Wait, what?
Yes. He.
So that was the real John Heyman?
But it was the real John Heyman.
Hold on a second.
I did the check and make sure it, like, the alerts are on and everything. And then he retracted it and said, Giants say they have not heard from Aaron Judge. My apologies for jumping the gun. So my apologies as well. But yes, John Heyman retracting his Aaron Judge to the Giants news.
I will not retract it because I don't have journalistic integrity. Aaron Judge to the Giants via Ben Ennis. I had it first, so please credit me if in fact he ends up a San Francisco Giant.
It's a tough one. Like, we went through, you and I had the discussion of like in the new fake Twitter era, like, how do you be careful? And it's like tweet deck columns, notifications on the phone, all those boxes are checked. There is no check for reporter has to take back his report.
That's embarrassing. That's, I was going to say something disparaging about another reporter, which I won't do. Anyway, so we'll continue.
Was it me?
No, not you. I'll tell you in the break. But yeah, we'll continue to monitor that story. We'll talk to our pal Ben Nicholson-Smith on the ground in San Diego after 6 o'clock. But coming up next, we got the first ever meeting of two NHL players, both riding 18-game point streaks, and Mitch Marner's riding a 19-gamer. But Jason Robertson's like maybe going to win the Hart Trophy this year as the Leafs are in Dallas. We'll talk to Frank Saravelli, director of hockey content at dailyfaceoff.com. Next, the Fan Drive Time continues. Sportsnet 590 The Fan. All right, Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Ben Ennis, Blake Murphy. Poor John Heyman getting dragged over the coals here. It's a rough one.
Well, arson Judge news.
He didn't spell Aaron Judge correctly. He called him arson. And no, nothing's officialized. Aaron Judge is not a San Francisco Giant yet. I mean, that may end up being the case. I mean, he had a long conversation with Tom Brady yesterday, of course,
sure,
in Northern California.
Chelsea Janes, the national-based reporter for the Washington Post, got a quote from Larry Bear, the Giants CEO, who said 2 seconds ago, nothing to report. So the arson typo Only the second biggest mistake in that tweet.
It's true.
Poor guy.
Let's talk to somebody who never makes a mistake. He is Frank Saravelli, director of hockey content at dailyfaceoff.com. And your team didn't get an Aaron Judge, but you got yourself a Trey Turner. Congratulations.
Yes, we did get a Trey Turner. $1 billion committed by the Philadelphia Phillies to six players. It's a mind-blowing number, but what you guys are talking about with John Heyman is actually my worst nightmare playing out in real time.
Yeah, it looks miserable. I've never been in a position where anybody, like, respected my tweets to begin with, so it's not an issue for me.
Like, this literally keeps me awake at night.
Do you want to hear something worse than being kept awake at night, Frank? One time I woke up and I had dreamt that a trade happened, and I actually, like, got up and started writing.
No way.
Yeah, and I remember it very... It was...
What was the trade?
It was Luis Scola to the Chicago Bulls for a second-round pick. The trade didn't make any sense, but I got up and started writing it, and...
You were getting up to make sense of it. That's what you were doing.
Yeah, and when I realized that it hadn't happened was when I looked for the Woj tweet to, like, link to in my article. I couldn't find it, and then... eventually realized that I had dreamt it. So being kept up...
That wasn't
up
a Woj bomb. That was a Blake bomb.
Yeah. Luckily, I didn't post it or, like, comment on it on Twitter.
Oh, man. Yeah.
It was so a lot. Good.
Yeah, that's insane. Also insane, but, like, in a different type of way, is two players riding at least an 18-game point streak playing against each other for the first time in NHL history tonight. Leafs in Dallas. Jason Robertson's, like, really freaking good. Jury's out on Nick still, but... he's right up there as far as odds on Bet Rivers to win the Hart. He and Connor McDavid, his team's having a better season than the Oilers, that's for sure. I know it's so early, Frank, but you know, where does Jason Robertson rank in your MVP rankings?
He ranks number two, and that's behind only Connor McDavid, but I will say that it's rather close. But when you look at, to this point, how ridiculously good McDavid has been, he's 7 points clear of Robertson at this moment in time and has only one fewer goal. And when you consider that Robertson is one of the fastest players ever to 20 goals in the salary cap era, he now has 23 in 25 games. It speaks to how much Connor McDavid has elevated his goal scoring capability. And so that's been a huge factor in where I would rank my Hart Trophy leaders or front runners, I should say, at the moment.
So Robertson was obviously a big enough prospect, but he was a second round pick. He didn't have, you know, all the buzz in the world. He comes second in the Calder two seasons back. And then last year is kind of a point of game guy. And now is in the MVP conversation at 23. This all seemed to have come together. Like, the ceiling keeps rising higher on him year by year. What did we miss with Robertson, or what's clicked for him to kind of accelerate the development curve here?
I think part of it, this might sound really funny to say, and this is a story that hasn't been told all that often, might actually be fitness. That he totally changed himself. He started with the Texas Stars, but he came to the Stars in the AHL out of junior, and Mike McKenna, who I work with, of course, at Daily Faceoff, was the goalie for the Texas Stars then, and they had to send him home because he was so out of shape. And I wonder if that plus, you know, some development in his game, like, he's scoring now at a level that he didn't come close to in junior hockey. Like, it's so rare to see a player take this type of step. And the question is, what were we missing? Like, I don't think anything. Like, there was some talent there, but if you gave Jim Nill and the Dallas Stars some truth serum, the answer that you'd get is they had no idea that he could be this good. Take a look back at that 2017 draft, by the way, and it is absolutely magical for the Dallas Stars. Miro Heiskanen, third overall, Jake Oettinger, 26th overall, followed closely by Jason Robertson at 39th. How about checking all three positional boxes for your team with studs and then setting your team up for the next 15 years in terms of a competitive window? Jim Nill was part of some incredible drafting with the Detroit Red Wings organization as their assistant GM and director of scouting for a long, long time. And I asked him about this a couple weeks ago, and he said, this class in 2017 for Dallas rivals anything that the Red Wings did, which you know carries a ton of weight.
Yeah, and like drafting top five, I think, is different than the second round, or even honestly taking a goalie in the first round, as we well know, with Ilya Samsonov being a member of the Toronto Maple Leafs and not a Washington Capitol right now, but also Roope Hintz, who got the bag this year, another second round pick. Like, is this, are the Dallas Stars the franchise we should look to when it comes to the NHL draft right now because of their recent success?
I think so. I mean, it's that impressive, and especially when you get some of these later round hits, it's the percentage of a hit on second round picks and beyond, it diminishes really quite quickly once you get out of that first round pick range. And I don't know exactly what the math is, but I think it's a 1 in 5 shot that a second round pick even makes it to the NHL. That was the last number that I had heard. And it kind of, when you consider those odds and you consider how teams have drafted, or I guess I should say with the success with which they've drafted, it sort of makes you rethink the idea of trade deadlines and acquisitions, because you know you might be better off moving those picks at a certain point depending on what you're looking at.
So Jason Robertson, very, very good, and you could see this coming. He's a little bigger player than Nick Robertson, obviously, but Nick Robertson has all the talent in the world, and you want to talk about scoring in junior and ability in the AHL. He's done all that, and it hasn't necessarily translated to the National Hockey League. His best game came against the Dallas Stars, of course, at Scotiabank Arena earlier this season. There's been a lot of back and forth. And in fact, Jason was on the JD Bunkus podcast today talking about how maybe Nick doesn't have a head coach that believes in him enough. He's in the lineup.
That's spicy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in that regard. But yeah, so this is a guy that has been the Leafs' top forward prospect for a while here now. It's been kind of in and out of the lineup, but hasn't necessarily deserved, I guess, a long runway. How do you view it as far as the Toronto Maple Leafs and the way they've handled Nick Robertson this season?
Honestly, knowing the talent that Nick Robertson has, like, they're not leaving him out of the lineup because they want to or because it's best for his development. He's out of the lineup because he's not there yet. He hasn't reached the bar that some other players ahead of him on the depth chart have set. And I don't know that it's necessarily about lack of opportunity or the coach not believing in him. These are two different players. Nick Robertson is 6 inches shorter than his brother, if that's not nearly enough an indication for you. What's interesting to me is as Jason has taken off in Dallas, you see this a lot with some players that come with bloodlines and pedigree from dads that played in the NHL, is the success that they had that made them so good in their NHL careers often rubs off on their son in terms of training. I don't know what it's been like for Nick, and I'm not suggesting anything otherwise. I'm just surprised that more of what Jason Robertson has been working on, because clearly it's been working, hasn't, you know, really translated into anything that Nick is doing, if that makes any sense.
It does make sense. And again, like you said, you'd have to get in there and ask and see. I guess my question that follows from that, though, with Nick Robertson is, I don't think anyone needs to see more of him with the Marlies. We know that he's a point-of-game guy over chunks of 3 seasons now around that injury. And no, he hasn't performed up to expectation when he's been with the Leafs, with the exception of that Dallas game earlier in the year. But what does a guy in this situation do to break through? Because he's not playing with the Marlies, so even if he was showing growth down there, you might be skeptical about it anyway, but he's not getting in a lineup regularly. So how do you show that? What does that look like for him to take that step and avoid, you know, kind of that quad A label that some guys who are point of game in the AHL and never really get a huge chance in the NHL get labeled with sometimes?
I think the real answer to your question, Blake, is how does he break through? And it's somewhere else. I mean, at least at this very moment in time, that he's been given opportunity to break through, and you've seen limited glimpses of it, and mainly, you know, just that game against Dallas that you can really point to and say he was a true factor in the game. And other than that, he sort of is exactly what you described him right now. Not to say he can't be anything more than that in the future, but he's the pro hockey is littered with quad A players. It just is. Guys that are excellent in the AHL and struggle to translate in the NHL. And I just don't see much more of a bigger opportunity coming unless there's some injury that is unforeseen that pops up and it's the Leafs this year. You never know. But right now I don't see any magical opportunity or shining light coming for Nick Robertson as it currently stands.
Talking to Frank Saravalli.
What I'm saying is that sounds like some pretty good collateral for whatever the Leafs are looking at for the deadline.
Yeah, maybe that's the case. And certainly they'll be adding at the deadline at this current rate. They're really, really good now. They're not scoring a bunch of goals, but they're really doing a good job of limiting them. And a lot of that has to do with the goaltending they've gotten, despite the fact that Samsonov and Matt Murray have taken turns being hurt. And Eric Schallgren spent a lot of time in net for this Maple Leafs team. They're really good after being not very good as far as save percentage is concerned a season ago with guys that are different than the ones they currently have in net. Curtis Sanford took over for Steve Briere in the offseason as the Leafs goalie coach. And I mean, it's such a weird position for people who have never played it, right? Like goaltending is voodoo is what you continually hear and see. How much credit should we be giving? And I know it's early on, and Samsonov had a great start to last season, and Matt Murray actually had a great start to last season in Ottawa as well. But at this point, how much credit should be given to Curtis Sanford?
I think a pretty significant amount. You'd have to really break down the technical aspects of what changes we've seen from Matt Murray. But I think there's also a healthy amount due to Murray and Samsonov themselves and for similar, albeit different reasons in how they ended up at that point. Similar in that they both have a lot to prove. Murray, because of injury and his career had fallen on hard times, and Samsonov because he had sort of run out of trust in Washington. And even if, you know, it's a stretch to say that if things didn't work out in Toronto, that his career in the NHL might be over, because I think with that type of pedigree and talent and that age, that someone would be taking a chance. But this is kind of it for Murray. Like, if he didn't find a way to turn it around with the Leafs, like, at that contract, even with what's been retained by Ottawa, no one's stepping forward to acquire that guy if he doesn't get right. And it was such an inauspicious start with the injury, and that was the one thing that DJ Smith, the Sens coach, you know, sort of knocked on. I was like, hey, how was Matt Murray for you? And his answer was like, I never saw him because he was always hurt. And that derailed a lot of the technical aspect of whatever they might have tried to work with him in Ottawa. And Sanford comes in, and you saw the work that Murray put in practice, even in days that he couldn't be part of practice, you know, without pads on, in a sweatsuit, working on whatever he could technically, that I think was really important to see this rebound. And I want to, you know, just step forward and eat a little crow myself, because I've been one of Murray's biggest doubters in the sense that he hadn't showed it in the last few years, the ability to change his game in a way that meets the current style of NHL goaltending required. He was playing 5-6 years ago in terms of what worked and hadn't changed with the times, that now it seems like he's on the path to fixing that.
Frank, Matt Murray, one of the most fun stories here in Toronto early this NHL season. One of the most fun stories league-wide, the Seattle Kraken being very, very good. They will bring Shane Wright back into the fold tonight against Montreal. What does the Shane Wright situation look like for the near term here? I'd imagine it's possible he's released for the World Juniors. What does the rest of the season look like for Wright in Seattle?
Well, right now, what's in front of us, it's this game tonight against the Montreal Canadiens, and what sweet revenge that would be for Shane Wright after the way that draft unfolded. You know, I've been to 15 NHL drafts in my life, and I can never remember an environment quite like that. The gasps, the roar when the Montreal Canadiens selected Slafkovsky number one overall. So those two going head to head is quite juicy. I would call it, even though it's the later game, it's the undercard to this night, given the streaks that are on the line. But after that, tomorrow, I believe, Team Canada opens their World Junior Camp, and I'd imagine that Shane Wright will be released for that. We'll play the tournament and then come back to the Seattle Kraken, at which point they'll have to make a decision. Are we sending you back to Kingston or wherever that may be in the OHL if Kingston decides to not hang on to him, and then move on from there? Because, you know, I think the decision is quite clear at this point, having gone to the AHL, putting up 4 goals in 5 games, where he's best suited. The answer truly, unfortunately, is the AHL. But given where he's been in the Kraken lineup, the lack of minutes, and clearly where Dave Haxtell and his staff thinks that he is, that it's not the NHL at this time.
Frank, always great. We'll chat next Tuesday. Thanks, man.
Sounds good, guys. Have a good night.
You too. Frank Saravelli, Director of Hockey Content at DailyFaceoff.com. So this Leafs goaltending thing is, I was going to say it's a head-scratcher for me, but it's not. Like, goaltending has been good. What I am scratching my head about is whether this team is truly just good at limiting goals outside of the goaltending, or they're being propped up by really, really good goaltending. Because, like, even Eric Schallgren, it's like a couple of goals above expected in the games that he's played for the Toronto Maple Leafs. And I was looking at the 5-on-5 stats for this team today, and they're third in goals against per 60 minutes, which is really, really good. That's really good. But they're 11th in the NHL in expected goals against per 60, which can be okay. They would have been expected to allow more goals than they've actually given up, which is, hey, okay, how's that happening? They're 5th in high danger goals against per 60, which is really good. They're not allowing a lot of goals from high danger areas. They're 17th in high danger Corsi against per 60. They're 3rd in high danger save percentage. They're 5th in 5-on-5 save percentage. To me, Blake, that's kind of telling, especially the high danger Corsi against per 60. Like, they're allowing a lot of shot attempts from really dangerous areas and getting bailed out by their goaltending. That seems alarming.
It is alarming, and it's something, you know, I've mentioned a couple times in trying to tiptoe around just how special it's been for this team to hang in there from a win-loss perspective with all these defensive injuries, is that a team that was very, very, very good at controlling possession and things like that early in the year has continued to be good defensively, but in a very different way, and that's not allowing a lot of goals in your own zone. Now, I also mentioned the other week that there is some evidence that at this point in time and this point in the season, what you've actually allowed starts to become a better predictor than expected goals or expected goals against. But when we talk to our pals who study goaltending and things like that, the high danger stuff is, so in general, I don't think the save percentage outlier is a massive concern, because there is some evidence that you can have a system that helps with that stuff and helps your goalies along. And the Leafs do have a good defensive crop of forwards. The high danger stuff, though, is serious. And yeah. I want to say that all the karma for that has just manifested in overtime. Yeah. Every time the Leafs get too many good high danger saves, it's like, well, guess what happens in overtime when you give up a breakaway? I don't know if the chickens are coming home to roost in that regard at some point, but yeah, color me a little bit skeptical that this goaltending trio is elite at high danger.
Yeah. If they are, then that's a fine way to win hockey games. Have good goaltending. Like, you're allowed to win games on the strength of your goaltending.
It's way nicer to be on this side of it.
And honestly, it must be said, over the last half decade, they haven't had the superior goaltending in large part. All right. When we come back, we'll go down to San Diego, see what the hell's going on with Aaron Judge. And we'll get a Blue Jays perspective as well from Ben Nicholson-Smith. As the Fan Drive Time continues, Ben Ennis, Blake Murphy, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.